Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Maya Shenhuar is editor-in-chief of Truthout, an independent social justice news website. In addition to Truthout, she has written about the prison industrial complex for the New York Times, The Guardian, and Ms. Magazine. Her new book is Locked Down, Locked Out: Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. It is a personal book where she combines extensive research with the stories of individual prisoners and their families, including her own family's experience of her sister's incarceration. It is a pleasure to welcome Maya Shenhuar to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
What brought you to this subject of looking at prisons?
Well, it's kind of two strains. I have been reporting on prisons as a journalist for about 10 years and kind of looking at things from the policy angle and the sentencing angle and the angle of prison conditions. At the same time, my sister has been in and out of prison and jail. So I've had this very personal, though unwanted, connection to the system also for almost 10 years. And so the book is really the first time that I've kind of brought those strains together, the journalism and the personal, and kind of put it together into sort of a more overarching message about the system and how it affects the rest of society.
That message, really in a nutshell, and not to simplify it too much, is that this system often helps to destroy families and communities, and ultimately, in its effort to make us more safe, is making us less safe. I'm curious as to how long it took you to develop that notion.
Well, I think it was a little bit of a rocky road, because even after I had developed it in theory, kind of putting it into practice, even in my daily life, was a little bit of a struggle. And I'll give an example. So I could see through research and also through how things were playing out with my sister and other prisoners that I was in contact with, the prison was not leading to some sort of transformation for them. It was never a correction. It was always kind of a step in the direction of becoming further entrenched in the criminal justice system. But at the same time, when you have a person who's become embroiled in this system, kind of you can't stop the cycle so easily. So there were actually times where I wanted my sister to go back to prison because I didn't know what else she could do. And so I think that really over the past couple of years, really right up until the end of the time that I was writing the book, I was still kind of wrestling with, okay, even if prison doesn't work in theory, even if we can see kind of the larger picture of how this institution is destroying individual families and then by virtue of that destroying society in many ways, how do we come at this from a practical individual angle? And so I've been juggling kind of those two challenges for a while.
One of the points that you make, I think, is fascinating, and it is that idea of the bonds of family can be so helpful in helping the person who is going to prison, to help the person who is in that system, that those bonds are broken just by the nature of the system, and they're really the only lifeline that the person has when they're in the facility and when they come out.
Right. Yeah, we think in other contexts, like in drug and alcohol treatment, for example, all the time about this idea that, well, if you want a person to change, if you want a person to move toward a healthier and more stable life, what do you nurture? You nurture relationships and bonds. And ultimately, those relationships are what motivate a person to change and to seek alternatives. Now, of course, we also have to be doing the work of providing those alternatives and providing stepping stones and resources for people so that they have other things they can do besides whatever criminal activity got them locked up. But I think that prioritizing those relationships and thinking about how bringing people together as opposed to figuring out ways to isolate people more and more can actually ultimately nurture public safety.
In that idea of nurturing public safety, how does that work in your mind? How does that end up? The end result, how do we get there?
I think that it's really about a number of different paths. Because right now we have this idea with prison that there's kind of a blanket solution when it comes to the idea of safety, that, oh, well, someone does something wrong or you think someone's going to do something wrong, and so you lock them up, you take them off the street or whatever kind of framework you're using. And that is for everything from marijuana possession to murder. And so if you're not taking that for granted, that that's somehow the solution to making things safer, then you have to think about things specifically, problem by problem. Okay, so when it comes to small theft, why is it happening? Are there ways to, A, address some of the root causes that are leading to theft? For example, poverty or institutions being downgraded in a neighborhood so people have fewer resources. On the level of what happens when a theft takes place, are there ways to actually bring together the people who are causing these problems with the people who are affected by them and let those people kind of talk to each other, have the people who are affected share the impact of the crime with the people who are perpetrating the crime? That's called restorative justice. So there are all kinds of solutions that need to happen on the front end and the back end, both. And those strategies have actually been shown to reduce crime. And the theft is just, you know, one example. It would be different solutions, obviously, for violent crimes in many cases. And so it's hard work, and it's partially trial and error, but we do have to start thinking of the individual situations that are causing violence and pain and damage in our communities, instead of just thinking, okay, this particular thing falls into the checkbox of crime, and therefore it's punished with less or more prison.
Let's use your sister's experience as an example, but we're talking about prison, and so often prison is called a correctional facility. But what are we actually correcting? What is being done to correct the individual who is being incarcerated? So in your sister's situation, what do you feel would have been a more appropriate approach to help correct that problem?
Well, I think that one thing we have to keep in mind is that a lot of people are getting arrested for things that maybe are not even, they're classified as crime, but they're not necessarily harming other people in society. And that particularly happens to people of color, particularly happens to poor people. But there's a large range of things classified as crimes where people are ultimately not hurting anyone or just hurting themselves. In my sister's situation, she was addicted to heroin. And so all of the things that she was doing that were getting her locked up, all of these small offenses, all stemmed from what was really a health problem. And drug addiction over the past few decades has been reframed as a criminal offense, when really, think about all the other medical problems that are considered health issues in our society, and drug addiction actually is one of them. In fact, alcohol addiction is considered a public health problem. So I think that in my sister's case, if from the get-go her situation had been seen as kind of a symptom of a public health problem, and then on a personal level, a health concern. Things would have taken a turn that ultimately may have really helped her. And I mean, that's not to say that shifting public policy or shifting public mindsets can solve all health problems. She may well have stayed addicted to heroin, but instead of being put in situations where she needed to hide that addiction to the point that she was consistently putting herself in danger, she would have been able to carry on her life and hopefully be provided with harm reduction strategies. And I share a couple of examples in the book of how that's being done in other countries, particularly a program in Vancouver that works with heroin addicts, actually supplying them with small amounts of heroin at injection centers so that they can take it in a healthy way, a way that they can continue their lives and have medical supervision. So it's definitely thinking outside the box, but again, it comes back to questioning that definition of crime. If my sister's actions had not been considered a crime, ultimately she would have been in a much healthier and stabler position, and that would have been good for not only her, but anyone else affected by her actions since.
What do you find to be commonalities in the stories that you talk about in the book and the people that you spoke to? What are the commonalities?
Well, I think that a lot of the people I spoke to in the book, so these are all prisoners that I correspond with, mostly through letters. And the strains that I kept hearing from people when they talked about their experience were about this idea of isolation and this idea that the things that they valued most in life were slipping away and were completely out of their control. So a sense of helplessness as well. And I think this is something about prison that people often don't think about, because you think of, okay, these are bad guys, they need to be contained. Well, really, they're put in a position that is so helpless and in which you're making so few choices that really the ability to make choices, which is ultimately something we want to be cultivating, is completely, that falls by the wayside. And at the same time, you're losing those important things, those connections. People talk about how they used to receive a letter every week from their mother, and then it goes to a month, and then every 2 months they're getting a letter from their mom. They can't get through on the phone. Well, you have no idea what's going on if you can't get through on the phone when you're calling someone from prison. The phones go one way, you know. You can't receive phone calls. So just all of these different ways in which people feel alone and helpless. And then I think the last thing I'd say is that there's kind of a constant trauma to being incarcerated. So a lot of times people say, well, you know, you might question incarceration for drug offenses and that maybe, but there needs to be prison for violent offenses. Well, most people who go into prison for a violent offense have already experienced some kind of trauma. And then prison, just the act of caging a human being, is traumatizing. So they experience this further violence every day. And the research shows that hurt people hurt people. You continue traumatizing someone, and that does make them more likely to tend toward violence. And so hearing from people about the violence that's inflicted on them, both by guards, both, you know, getting in fights and that kind of thing, but also just the violence of being caged, that's really something that stuck with me.
Maya Shenhua is author of the new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. The book is published by Barrett Kohler Publishers. Maya Shenhua, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me on, Joe.
Very nice to have you with us. Again, the title of the book is Locked Down, Locked Out by Maya Shenhua. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.